Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you as we are here every week at 10 a.m. And remember, our shows are archived on the homepage. So if you missed part of this, want to hear it again, or want to have a friend listen to it, we will be there. Interesting show today. Lots of stuff going on. And my leadoff guest is Jennifer Mattingly. She is Director of Government Affairs. Did I get that right, Jennifer?
You got it right.
For Shaw, Bransford, and Roth, very well-known law firm in Washington. They're sort of pioneers in the area of public and federal employee law.
Yes, they are.
And first place, how did you get here? How did you? This is a very important job for a very important outfit.
Yeah, you know, it's great to work at Shaw Bransford. It's really been interesting to see all of the things they do for the federal community. So that's been fun. It was sort of a random journey to get there. I've worked in politics for many years, mostly out in Oregon before, been in D.C. for the last 10 years and started working at smaller associations doing state policy and politics, and saw one day that they needed somebody at Shaw Bransford and got in. And it was something that was close to my heart because I come from a family of career federal employees. So my father was a career federal employee. My husband is a career federal employee. So it's really nice to be in the family, so to speak, and be supporting something that I grew up with and truly believe in.
Yeah, well, again, you're right place at the right time.
Yep.
Couldn't be more. What is the ancient Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times. We are certainly living in interesting times these days. Let me ask you, start off with this latest proposal by a Senator Marco Rubio, and I have a mea culpa here. I got a tip on it yesterday, and it was one of these things. I didn't see it, but I heard it. And when he made a reference, the person was reading me the speech, when they made a reference to retirement, I assumed it was FERS, the Federal Employees Retirement System.
And I think a lot of people did.
I think they did. Yeah, we went that way. But it was wrong. And it, when he meant retirement, he, in his politician way, was referring to the Thrift Savings Plan or something like it. What's your take on his proposal?
You know, it's interesting because it's similar to some of these other proposals we've heard with FEHBP, with the different things where Congress or various members have said, well, if I get this benefit, the American people should get this benefit. And so it's certainly something, and I believe that was similar to what Senator Rubio said, which was, why should Congress have access to this great thrift savings plan and the American people don't? You know, and I think in some respects, people do. Some people do have access to very good 401ks.
Yeah.
You know, they run the gamut, and companies run the gamut on what they offer their employees as well. And so I don't think it's totally fair to say that nobody in the public is getting something that federal employees, you know, there's definitely comparisons out there.
Yeah, it's sort of a populist thing. Mm-hmm. I guess the differential, if somebody was looking at it, would be that for people under the FERS program, which is the vast majority of feds, they are eligible for that 5% match.
Right.
That's unusual in the private sector. And also the availability of the G fund is a super safe, never has
right.
a bad day.
There is some stability that you don't
yeah.
always get in 401ks in the private sector. But, you know, with any plan, and this was our worry when we first heard proposals about a year or two ago to open up FEHB, is what does it do to the stability of the plan? Would it remain a really good plan if all of a sudden everybody was in it because you have more people,
yeah.
more things going on? And so then maybe it loses some of the benefits of why they wanted to open it up in the first place.
Well, I wonder down the road if the FEHBP might not be revisited because Congress did what many of us thought was the unthinkable. They took themselves out of it. And I
right.
never thought they'd do that. I thought they would be hypocritical about it and ride it, that puppy, for years and years, but they would never leave it. They're gone. They're in the district exchange now.
Yep, and that's always been the concern, sort of the behind the scenes concern, is what happens when Congress no longer has a vested interest in this
exactly.
program? Do they then start going after it? Because they've gone after so many other federal benefits lately. I haven't seen it so far, a concerted effort to do that. Doesn't mean it's not coming at some point, but so far it's, you know, and every company, not every company, but a lot of companies, especially big ones that would be comparable to the government in some respects, offer their employees various benefits, health care, retirement, some of those things. And some companies offer way more benefits than the government does,
yeah.
you know, paid leave and those sorts of things. So, you know, so I think it's fair to say that the government has a very good compensation package. But it's not one that's abnormal compared to a Fortune 500 or a Fortune 100 company.
Yeah. Well, I would have never thought that they would remove themselves from the FEHBP. I wonder if one factor in this is not the fact that And I don't know if this is, if it's worse or better now than at any point in our history. I don't know the history of the Congress and who was in it, but we have more than half the members now are millionaires. And
that's
got to be a factor.
I think that is. I think it's, you know, some of it is just a way of looking, but I think part of it is just a way of talking about things these days, as it is that populist strain of, you know, what I have, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander sort of thing. And but I do think that sometimes things are just talk, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they go down that road. I think there's a lot of other things on Congress's plate right now that, frankly, are probably more pressing in terms of budgets, in terms of, you know, immigration. They've got all this whole checklist of things they wanted to get done. And so I think that's certainly more on their radar screen than FEHB.
Well, you know, this ancient history, but I remember back in the day, I covered the Hill pretty closely. I was up there every day, and you know people. You get to know some of the members. You get to know the staff very well. And I was surprised at how many members of Congress, well, actually, I wasn't surprised. At the time, it made sense, were literally living off their paycheck. Better than most people, but still not a lot of money. And many of them had money problems. Many of them had to get reelected. I remember one particular congressman from this area who I won't mention, but one of his kids was having major medical problems, and his primary goal for getting reelected was to remain in the FEHBP, the federal health plan. And I remember going to a dinner, was sitting next to the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, and all he did was complain about his bills and how much he owed, and he obviously didn't have money.
Well, and I think you still hear that, because there was a member of Congress, and I'm forgetting who specifically it was, I think out of Georgia, a couple months ago, that made some comment about, you know, I need this retirement plan. I need this health care because I don't make a lot of money. And so part of it is perspective on where you come from as to what you really think. And I think Congressman Moran recently made some comments to the effect of, it's really expensive to live here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, the actual pay of a member of Congress isn't, for this area, you know, it may sound large in other areas of the country, but for this area, it's not exorbitant in that term. And so I do think, you know, I think it's just become an easy thing to go after and talk about. Taking themselves out of the FEHB was a little different because that had to do with the broader Affordable Care Act, and there were the politics around that. But typically, they've made changes prospectively when they've talked about FERS or any of these others. They haven't made changes to the current plan. And I think that's where the trend likely lies, is looking ahead versus looking at what people really have right now.
Well, I heard there was a big fight up on Capitol Hill within the House and Senate staff, because if you're in a certain category, you remain in the FEHBP. But if you're in another category, I don't know, committee staff, then you go under the Affordable Care Act. And they did not like that. Some people quit or switch jobs.
Yeah, it's certainly, and that's something that every person considers when you take a job. Are you going to get health care? Are you going to get retirement benefits? And so that was a calculation that some of these folks had to make as well. And it's unfortunate that if it drove good people out, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Jennifer, what are you working on now? What are the issues? Because I'll tell you, my thought is that Congress the last couple of years has each year established a new record for not being in town. They've been out doing other things. This year, prelude to the elections, 2016, everybody's out campaigning for this year. What's going to happen, or if anything?
Well, and that's the if anything, maybe the point on this. We don't see things move as quickly as they used to. It depends on the issues, but I don't foresee, you know, they are working through, because of the budget deal, they are working through appropriations bills because they already knew top line numbers. So they're moving some of those things forward. They've got the defense authorization is moving forward as well. But in terms of federal employee specific issues, it's, we haven't seen a lot really go forward in terms of a concrete legislation so far. That doesn't mean, we've still got a couple months until recess and until campaigning really begins, but more of what we're hearing are things being introduced. You've got this issue with the VA and some of these bills out there to cap or ban SES performance awards, to allow, there's one to allow the VA secretary to remove senior executives without any due process. So we do see things that are being discussed. Whether they're going to actually see the light of day, that's still unclear.
Yeah, well, the VA situation is interesting because members from both the House and the Senate have jumped on the VA for allegedly covering up or denying care to veterans who need it very badly. They serve their country. They're old men and women now, and there have traditionally been problems with the VA, but they want to go after it. Secretary Shinseki has said he doesn't want it, he doesn't need it, but the Congress is saying, you're going to get it, buddy, and then presumably they're going to hold his feet to the fire to use it.
Well, and it's interesting because that bill, it's H.R. 4031 in the House, and it's certainly been a priority of Chairman Miller, who's chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. The speaker has also gotten on it. But I think there are a lot of people in the House and Senate who have concerns about doing that. And certainly from my perspective, this gets back to hundreds of years of an idea starting with the Pendleton Act back in 1883, I think, or 1888. But there was a reason why they
did it.
Got rid of the victor goes the spoils.
I want to ask you about the threats to the executives, but Lauren Larson's giving us the hook here. So we need to take a very short break. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Jennifer Mattingly. She's Director of Government Affairs for Shaw, Bransford & Roth, one of the leading law firms in the city and one that specializes in federal employment law. And Jennifer, before we were rudely interrupted at the break, we were talking about senior executives, and there's so much going on the Hill now, and some of the news is what's not going on. For example, they up until recently, one of the big deals has been these Distinguished Service Rank Awards for members of the Senior Executive Service, and they have a banquet every year at the State Department, which they pay for, the membership pays for. But it's a wonderful event, and the White House in the last couple of years has really downplayed this or almost ignored it.
Well, what they have, and this is a statutory award given by the Presidential Distinguished Rank Awards, and they have both distinguished and meritorious, and they really recognize outstanding service and a career of outstanding service. It's not just a point in time of senior executives or SLST employees who are equivalents. And the winners have done things over the years. We've had Nobel Prize winners. Oh. We've had astronauts. There have been people last year, the 46 winners collectively saved $94 billion with the things they had done for the government. So these are people who really have, really who you want to hold up and say, this is the best of what government yeah. does, and we should be talking about these people. But over the last year or two, there's been this pressure from Congress, from the media, that says, oh my goodness, we have senior executives and they make performance awards. And so, you know, this idea that we need to ban performance awards, ban rank awards. And unfortunately, it's sort of from the perception that I don't know if people think, senior executives are getting a golden parachute, but it's certainly not that. It's certainly not what the private sector does. And I think there's this idea of what a private sector executive is. And these people have really dedicated their careers to working for the government. They could certainly work in the private sector and be having stock options and everything else. They don't get that. They're here because they really are dedicated to the mission. And so these rank awards recognize that dedication and their exemplary service. But what happened over the last year due to budgetary pressures is the administration did not award the awards for 2013. And then the news stories came out yesterday that the administration is redoing the awards and that they will award them going forward.
Yeah.
And part of the issue was that they had a monetary component to them. But for the senior executives, it's not the monetary piece that's in statute. It's as you're getting recognized for some incredible things.
I got the impression, too, that the administration was, for whatever reason, was almost embarrassed by this program. And they, you know, the president said, let's make government cool again. And I think he meant it at the time. But the political pressures on the anti-bureaucrat thing and the conservative movement, and it's almost as if the White House was pretending this stuff didn't happen, these people didn't exist. And I remember asking someone from Federally Employed Women, they were staunch supporters of the president and his reelection and everything. And I said, are you, not putting words in your mouth, but are you taking off the gloves? And she said, the left glove is off.
That's great.
Diplomatic.
So, you know, it's interesting because I think it does go back to this perception that the general public has that federal employees are overpaid. They're getting all these benefits and, you know, that they've got things that your average American citizen wouldn't have. And clearly that's not the case, but it was that perception out there. And I think that's what led to a lot of the rhetoric surrounding coming from Congress about how federal employees make money and make performance awards. And then probably that did lead to some of that pressure on getting rid of the rank.
Sure. And it's just so hard for the average person. It's not that the public is ignorant. It's just so hard for them to understand what they do. I've always thought and I mentioned this to Carol Bonacero, the president of the SEA, if they could do a documentary, let some independent person do it, of the banquet awards. All the men are in black ties and the women are in formal mm-hmm. attire. That beautiful setting, the Washington Mall and monuments and all that, at the State Department. And then you pick a table. And I've been every year but one, and probably for the last 20, 25 years. And I'm just blown away each year at the people I'm sitting with and what they've done. And these are not paper accomplishments. What they've saved, the science they've advanced, as you said, Nobel Prize winners and people who've circled the moon, which I have not done. And again, it's just mind blowing.
It is, and they all have a really fabulous story. And you know, the interesting thing too is that these rank awards, it's not just the government giving an award to one of its own. They're actually vetted by private citizens. There's actually a board that OPM puts together that has community leaders on it, business leaders, academics, you name it, from different regions around the country. And they actually go through and look at the nominations and make recommendations back to OPM, which then goes to the White House, about who they think is deserving and why. And so I think that's something that people don't realize. It's not just this internal, oh, I want to reward my buddy over here. It's actually a lot of thought goes into looking at what they did, nominating these folks, and then vetting them.
That's interesting because I talked to somebody once who was, I use the term judge, but he was on the board, and he's, you know, very accomplished guy, and he said this was one of the worst things he ever had to do. He hated it because the people were so good that each candidate, he'd say, okay, this one for sure. And then the next one would come along and he'd say, this. And he said he had to constantly reevaluate the criteria he was using and the way he was judging it because they were all so good.
Right. And so that, you know, it's a testament to the type of work that at all levels of government is going on. It's just that those stories don't get out there. I think about, you know, if you watch news stories or you look at what's being talked about on Twitter or wherever, it's not these positive stories that somebody did something really great. That's just not what trends these days. It's, you know, something else. So unfortunately, we hear all the negative. I kind of think back to growing up in high school or something where, you know, you had a friend dating somebody and you didn't like their boyfriend because all you heard was the negative stuff, even though things were really great. That's sort of what I feel like is the federal government. All you hear is the negative. So that's what people think. Even though overwhelmingly there's a ton of positive things going on.
Well, yeah, and there used to be a newspaper many years ago called The Grit, printed out of Pennsylvania, I think State College, but it was nationwide. This was back when people could wait for a couple of days for the news and get it by mail, but it was all good news. You know, it was all positive, all upbeat. Guess what? It doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
That's not what sells. That's not what people are interested in.
Yeah, and that's in the unfortunate
piece.
Yeah.
If it bleeds, it leads, as the newspaper creed. Back to the VA. VA's second, third largest of the federal agencies, touches many people, and I won't say everybody, but many people in a community. It's the largest employer in many communities, but also it's the place where you take your old father or your old uncle or your grandmother for service-related disabilities. And some of these people are in very bad shape, not only medically, but financially. They're living on maybe a VA benefit or a pension or something, but they're hard up. Families, it's a testing time for everybody. You go in with a sick person and you think they're not getting good enough service. In many cases, maybe they're not. You know, this is not a flack job for the VA. But if the VA gets this authority, which the secretary has said he doesn't need and by inference doesn't want, if they get this authority, it's going to hit everybody eventually, you think?
Well, the problem is, and that's sort of the, aside from the problems caused just for the senior executives at the VA, it's sort of a frightening precedent of making a section of the federal workforce at-will employees? Do they then become, does the senior executive service at the VA become just another layer of political appointees in that sense because they become at-will? And then how does that translate? Because there have been calls over the last few years to be able to fire federal employees generally, to be able to make them at will. How come they can't just be fired tomorrow? You know, you hear that all the time. And so it doesn't talk to the reality that we were mentioning before the first break of why hundreds of years ago they got rid of that, allowing people to just change over every time the administration changed over, or every time a political appointee changed over, because you couldn't fairly carry out the laws across administrations if your civil service was always changing over. So they put a barrier in there to make sure that federal employees had due process. And there's a bunch of cases over the years that have upheld that precedent. And so this is really a reversal of that distinction between a civil service and the politicals.
Well, and of course, you always have an example. A bad example, the Washington Times, I think today, is reporting in a situation at Housing and Urban Development where some employees, according to them, were needed to be fired, but they weren't. They were put back and buried in their jobs. And this is shown as an example of what the other 2.3 million federal workers are like.
Well, and I think to me, some of this, and clearly when somebody's doing something wrong, and, you know, Senior Executives Association and other groups have been very firm in saying this, if somebody's doing something wrong, they should be held accountable, you know, but, and I think the mechanisms in the system are there. We have to make sure, we've always said that managers are trained to understand how to deal with this, because there's an entire body of administrative law that governs the federal service that you don't have in the private sector. So you really do have to go through steps and processes and make sure, you know, principles of fairness and are being applied. But I do sometimes think it's a little disingenuous to say, look, the federal government doesn't hold people accountable, because, you know, you look at private sector jobs. How many employees have I heard in the private sector say, I've got a colleague who is slacking off and nobody's holding them accountable? I think part of that is human nature of, you know, how you deal with people. And nobody likes to deal with hiring, firing, some of those details. And so I do think it's part of it is just making sure managers and agencies have the tools in place and understand how to use them.
We need to take a break here, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you about RIFs, furloughs, that sort of thing. Be right back here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Jennifer Mattingly. She's Director of Government Affairs for Shaw Bransford Roth and has a very interesting career for someone so young. And we've been talking about the various things going on in government, including the TSP plan and the various things. I wanted to ask you about something else, because I think I'm confused, but I'm not embarrassed to say it, because I think it's a confusing situation. We have a two-year budget agreement. Be that as it may, agencies are still doing budgets. The House Republicans came up with their own budget. Sequestration is still with us. It seems to me some of these things are running together. Some are in conflict. And we're starting to hear talk, maybe just talk about buyouts, but mostly about reductions in force. And again, it's talk, early retirement as well. But I always thought that a reduction in force is maybe the tool of last resort, because it's so messy. The people have bumping rights and you have to establish groups and all that kind of thing. What are you hearing?
You know, people have said the word RIF for a long time, and I think that's always a concern whenever budgets get tight, and I think people worry about that, especially when we had furloughs. You know, that makes the idea of a RIF a little more of a reality, but I haven't heard anything concrete about that, more just, you know, floating around in the atmosphere of this could happen. Budgets are certainly still very tight for agencies. OMB has had guidance recently that says agencies need to try to trim their budgets even more, and certainly the numbers coming from the budget agreement, 70% of sequestration was still in place when Congress made the budget deal. So agencies are still under very, very tight constraints in trying to manage these resources. I would suspect that before agencies went down that road, I think last resort is a good way to put it, that you'd see buyouts. I really see attrition being the biggest effect out of all of this is that people just aren't, you know, they leave. We have a lot of folks who are retirement eligible, some agencies higher than others. And so those positions aren't being backfilled. And so, and we saw this a little bit in the 1990s when they went through the National Performance Review, and they did, in fact, cut quite a few folks from the workforce. And what happened is you have a lot of people left holding down multiple jobs, doing a lot of work. And so the attrition actually, I think, is in some ways more of a pernicious force on government and on agencies in terms of the work being done.
Than a RIF. The RIF may bump three or four people and not necessarily get the one you want, but with the attrition, it's the added workload.
Well, and attrition is happening now.
Yeah.
So a RIF, if that happens, certainly that would be a big factor, but that's an if. You know, right now we are seeing attrition and we are seeing the effects of some of the work not getting done, stretched resources, stretched personnel, and that starts having effect on morale. It has an effect on services. And so I think that's the biggest concern now.
Well, at the risk of both of us sounding like historians, you mentioned the Pendleton Act of 1883 or whatever it was, but a while ago, but there was a reason. There's a reason for having a civil service. And this was, some presidents got assassinated, disgruntled office seekers. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt came in and made some changes. I think people forget sometimes why we do what we do. May not be the good thing to do, and it may be outdated, but why we do things. And I think that's what fooled a lot of us who quote veterans covering the civil service, because we remember the government shutdown of 1995-96, and whatever your political party, whatever your leanings, the vast majority of people would say that the Democrats won and the Republicans lost. President Bill Clinton survived a lot of problems during that time, the shutdown. Newt Gingrich, the House Speaker, who was his primary enemy at the time, left, and the Republicans took a lot of heat. And I think many of us thought that when they were threatening a shutdown last year, that it wouldn't happen because people would remember what happened before, and it was a lose-lose for both sides, but particularly for the Republicans. What we didn't realize is that so many people, and Paul Ryan among them, the chairman of the Budget Committee, was not in Congress at that time. So maybe they were still in high school, but they have no memory of this. So it's unthinkable if you remember what happened, but they did it. So this is why I guess people are hedging their bets now. The Clinton administration in the 90s had a few reductions in force, but they wanted to keep the young, diverse group of people they'd hired. They knew a RIF would wipe them out, so they came up with the buyouts, the $25,000 before deductions payments, paid people to leave, people who had veterans preference who would not have been affected by a RIF. And so, again, we think they won't do that. They won't do a RIF because of the lessons of the Clinton administration. But that was a long time ago.
Well, and it goes back to with the shutdown, sometimes you got to, you know, touch the stove or touch it. You say with kids, you know, you got to get burned before you realize that that's really a problem. And it doesn't matter how many times your parents say, don't touch that. You're going to do it anyways. And that's sort of what we saw with the shutdown is they hadn't been through it. A lot of people had not lived through it or really seen its effects. And so there we went down that road again. So, you know, I do think that doing something like a RIF would probably not be on people's, if Congress could stop that or if they could help agencies out, I don't think anybody wants to go down that road before an election. I mean, I certainly think that would be a really interesting conversation and storyline right before a midterm election to have something like that go on, because you would see, as we saw with the shutdown, the American public went, wait a minute, I can't go to a park, I can't get to Social Security office. All of a sudden you'd start seeing some of those effects a little bit as they couldn't get in touch with people. And so I tend to be on the side of, I really don't think that that will happen, at least in the foreseeable future. It doesn't mean it won't happen, but I do think agencies are also finding ways, and you do hear all the talks of the really interesting innovations and technologies and things going on. So I do think there is some wiggle room there in terms of agencies managing their budgets.
Right. And, of course, the Republicans want to take over the Senate. The Democrats would love to hold on to it and make inroads in the House. But the way things have been going lately, it's almost as if, for a federal employee at least, gridlock is your friend.
Well, because nothing moves. And I think it's not just federal employees. I think I hear that a scuttlebutt on the street everywhere around here is that, you know, at least nothing good may be getting through, but nothing bad is getting through as well. And so.
And with federal workers, there rarely is anything good. It's just not like a big pay raise or some new perk or benefit. It's a takeaway. And so if you can have gridlock and doing nothing, no news in this case is good news.
Right. But I think it's also the opportunity of, while we have time, let's start talking about the good things that we can do. And I've seen that coming. I know a lot of the federal employee organizations, SEA, NARF, FMA, have all been looking at good things to do. And so let's talk about the positive and get out there where there's a void. Let's fill it with something good and the proactive things we can do to make government better.
Yeah. Well, and the attrition thing, which you said is maybe more dangerous and onerous to people, they could do that very easily, couldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they're
doing it to some extent. I think just, you know, Congress has tried. There are proposals out there for 1-for-3, but, you know, backfilling. And but I do think that's something that does give us the opportunity, my silver lining glass half full. Mm-hmm. Let's look at succession planning. Let's look at training. Let's look at all the good things that forces us to really focus on.
One last thing, the phased retirement, mm-hmm. which a lot of people, if they're telling the truth, a lot of people are hanging on just for that. Where do you think that is in the pipeline?
Well, I think it's gone through draft proposal and people have had an opportunity to comment. So I do hope that it'll only be a couple more months before we see that come out, because I know agencies are waiting for it and employees are waiting to use it as well.
End on a high note. That'll make a lot of people happy. Thank you, Jennifer Manning, for being with us. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times. We'll be right back after this short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm going to be talking with Andy Medici. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, are you there?
It's always good to be
here,
Mike.
Hey, thank you, sir. Thanks for being in. Listen, I looked at the Federal Times this week, and it looks like you wrote the entire pay issue. Is there anybody left over there but you?
Yeah, it's just that I'm hyper-focused on pay and benefits right now.
All right, good. Well, good time. Well, listen, I have to start out with a low point first here. A piece you have that says federal government less helpful than celebrity activists, according to a poll. What's that all about?
Yeah, there was an Allstate National Journal Heartland Monitor poll, and out of 1,000 people that they surveyed, only 21% thought that the federal government is mostly helping in tackling major challenges. But 24% thought that celebrity activists were mostly helping. So there's sort of a low point in federal opinion in this survey.
And you ran up a picture, I think, of Bono, who is always out saving the Horn of Africa or something.
Yeah, I think when people think celebrity activism, they think it's Bono. And I think this shows that something that we talk about, you know, almost on a weekly basis is a general perception of federal government and what it does versus, you know, what it actually does. And I think a lot of people are concerned, and they take those concerns out on what they see as the general federal government.
So if Justin Bieber and Joe Biden were in a popularity contest, we know who would probably win, at least with those 1,000.
Well, exactly right.
Hey, Andy, you said there's a bill that would drop the early withdrawal penalty, TSP penalty, for federal law enforcement people. What's that all about?
Well, it's a change in sort of the tax code. Right now, if you're a federal law enforcement officer, you can retire at the age of 50. A lot of them can, or in the 50s, but you suffer a 10% penalty for withdrawal if you do it before the age of 60. So this bill would remove that, and they would be allowed to withdraw without penalty when they actually retire, instead of having to wait up to about 9 years to be able to access those funds.
Right, because the early withdrawal penalty now for most people is what, 65 or 70?
Right, it's getting higher, and federal law enforcement, they have mandatory ages at which they have to retire, and that's usually in the upper 50s for most agencies, but that's still a couple years before they could withdraw from their TSP.
Right, and that would I assume that would impact air traffic controllers too.
Anyone in the federal law enforcement category, it also would apply to firefighters, border protection, and customs officers as well. So a wide slate of people in that category.
Hey, you understand you talked with the OPM director, Arcoletta, last week.
I ran into her and I had a chance to ask her about phased retirement.
Oh,
and
stop the presses. Phased retirement.
Well, I couldn't pin her down on an actual timeline. She said they were working on it and that it would be done soon. You know, I asked, does soon mean the summer? Does soon mean the fall? But she would only stress that they would be done soon, and she wouldn't be nailed down on a timeline.
Yeah. Well, she seems to be moving ahead. You know, after John Berry is a tough act to follow with the media and public opinion, but she seems to be, of course, she's a veteran of the government, so she knows the drill. But she seems to be moving along there.
Yeah, there are a lot of regulations that that have sort of stalled and looks like she's trying to push out the door. You know, there's also the flag benefit for fallen federal workers that's been in sort of limbo for a while, and OPM is working on finalizing those as well that would give, you know, federal workers who died in the line of duty that flag benefit that service members get. And she is focused on a lot of these smaller issues and making sure that they get done, you know, in a timely fashion.
You mentioned in a preamble this, we're talking about the Defense Department falling behind in its audit goals. What's that?
Well, in the most simplest form, it's exactly what any average person would recognize. You know, the Defense Department at the moment can't pass an audit, and lawmakers are hyper-focused on this because audits prepare you for the ability to find out how you're spending your money, where your money is coming from, what accounts they're coming from, whether you're paying the right people or the wrong people. And DOD has been told that they have to be audit ready, and this has been a more than 20-year process, and Congress keeps setting deadlines, DOD keeps missing them, and the current deadline is set for 2017 to be able to be what's called audit ready. But DOD is already sort of slipping on that timeline, and you know, lawmakers are none too happy about it.
It seems like, and I'm not trying to be flippant here, but it seems like a lot of people are slipping on things, and it's almost as if it doesn't matter. The Postal Service doesn't make its payments to the mandatory payments to the retirement fund. Goals are set for agencies, and they don't meet them. There are certain levels here, and it's as if things aren't happening and nobody much cares.
Well, when they write legislation, it's easy to ask someone or to tell someone to do something, but when it comes to a penalty for it, that's where a lot of people disagree. And so you have legislation that sets mandates and goals but provides no funding but also has no penalty. So, for example, if the penalty for an agency not being able to meet a deadline is that their chief gets hauled in front of Congress and yelled at for an hour or two, sometimes, you know, that's the price that a lot of agencies pay when there's tight budgets. So, you know, there is that conflict there, which is, you know, a lot of agencies really would like to meet goals and deadlines, but the resources are spread thin, and at the end of the day, if there's no penalty for it, then there's other obligations that they have to do by law first that they'd rather do.
That's right. It's not as if it's money out of their pocket or the guillotine.
Right, exactly. And at the end of the day, you know, there are certain things that they have to do by law. And so those basic agency functions, those are the things that they focus on first. And then when it comes to congressional mandates, things with penalties come next. And then if there's a goal that's a little bit that's unfunded and there's no penalty for it, you know, agencies will work as hard as they could to get that done. But at the end of the day, especially for DOD, there's a lot of forces pulling them in a lot of different directions. And for many people, being audit ready is not as high a priority as other mission areas.
Yeah. I was talking earlier with Jennifer Mattingly from Shaw, Bransford & Roth, and, you know, the inevitable subject of buyouts, early retirements, and RIFs, that nasty word for reduction in force, came up. And she said that she had heard talk, as we all have, and oftentimes it's not so much talk as it is a question. Someone will ask us what we've heard, and they will say the government is buzzing with rumors of RIFs, but it's really more people asking questions than any hard and fast stuff. Do you have any intelligence on that?
Well, for two agencies, I can tell you that the VA has no plans for buyouts, early outs, or RIFs at the moment. It's not something that they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the USDA, they told me that, you know, I've heard that they might offer up to 100 buyouts over the course of the year because they're reorganizing a lot of their bureaus and agencies. But as a total number, that's very, very small, and they have no plans for RIFs either. So those are two. I mean, I know that federal employees are always worried, and so we're always asking the question. And in a way, that's a good thing, because if anything ever changes, federal employees really want to know as soon as possible if RIFs are in the future.
Were we talking earlier being like last week, of the possibility or something about Air Force saying it might have some reductions in force?
Yeah, the Air Force has a plan to reduce, has a plan to offer buyouts and early retirements as well, and they've been doing that for the last 2 years. Last year, I think they actually RIFed 9 people after several hundred people were taken buyouts. So I think what the Air Force is doing is they're trying to offer buyouts and early outs in the right ways to reduce their workforce. But if there are a few people that don't take them or that are in the right areas, they will RIF them, but the numbers aren't large. We'll only get to large numbers if sequestration kicks in at full gear again after a year or two, or if there's some other congressional action. Right now, a lot of it is low-level stuff, but I think that's what keeps people's fears percolating, is that those are always options that are on the table.
You mentioned agriculture for possible buyouts, and it's interesting. That's a nationwide operation, and I believe the last couple of years they offered buyouts, but they were extremely selective. They were surgical. They were limited to certain jobs in certain outposts around the country.
Right. I mean, a lot of that, even though it's...
I'm sorry, Andy. We get the message here. My fault. We need to wrap it up for this week. But thank you very much for being here. We'll talk to you next week. Hope everybody rejoins us. Remember, every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.
Always a pleasure.